This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, my name is Amy Simon, and I'm a planetary scientist here at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. And the majority of the work I do is actually on the outer planet atmospheres, and so that's what I'm going to be talking about today. But I've been involved also with a number of missions, the Galileo mission to Jupiter, the Cassini mission to Saturn, briefly involved with the New Horizons mission when it flew by Jupiter. And so I've used a variety of different spacecraft to look at the outer planets, but I also use things back here at Earth, both ground-based and Hubble. And so what I'm going to show you is a variety of the different observations and types that we do, different spacecraft, different telescopes, and what they're telling us. And so just a brief outline, I'm going to talk a little bit about what it is that we exactly learn from the full-range UV-OIR and why using them all together is actually pretty important. But just also different types of observations that we take, and what you're going to see is compared to what you do for, say, an astrophysical object, we do a lot of different types of observations. They all tell us something different. So I'm going to talk a little bit about light curves, which is a fairly new thing, actually, for planetary. Feature tracking and monitoring, which is probably the stuff you're most familiar with, and then global mapping. And then lastly, why we can't use other types of facilities. Why can't we just do all this from the ground to start with? Or because we do send missions, why isn't that good enough? Why do we need this range, this suite of different types of observations? So observing in the UV-OIR, the first thing to remember is that each of the planets vary just a little bit. The level that the clouds are at, what they're made of, actually varies from planet to planet within our solar system. And so this curve on the right, this chart on the right, shows you what we think are the clouds and the giant planets. Now, note that I say what we think. We don't actually know. And this is based on what we do know about the bulk composition of the planets, what we do know about their temperatures, and what should condense out at various levels. So this is actually theoretical, what the clouds are made of on each of the outer planets. And so Jupiter and Saturn are somewhat similar. If you have an ammonia ice cloud at the top layer, that's the white clouds that you see. Ammonium hydrosulfide, which can turn red, but that isn't actually the red cloud that you see. And then water ice is way down low, and we don't see that pretty much at all. Only in very rare cases do we see water ice actually anywhere near the cloud tops on those planets. And so these are fairly deep down, and this is done in terms of altitude above the cloud tops, which isn't particularly helpful. But this is about the 1 bar level. So about room pressure on Jupiter is where you kind of get those first clouds forming. Now, when you get out to Uranus and Neptune, it's actually twofold to even have ammonia ice. If you have it, it's way down deep. The top clouds that we see are actually methane ice. And again, this is theoretical. We can't prove it because we can't sit there and sample the clouds. And that was actually one goal of the Galileo probe, which was supposed to solve all this. And it turns out it went into a hole in the clouds. It didn't see ammonia at all, which was not right. It didn't see water at all, which wasn't right. So that kind of threw everything into disarray. And so our current answer to that is it just went into a very bad place. So this is actually very hard to do. And spectroscopically, you don't see these clouds. That's just not what you see. And it's because you have this overlying haze and smog that's not shown in this type of diagram, kind of mutes out the signal of everything else.
Do you have other supporting observations to that hypothesis, or is it only the lack of these things which then leads to our idea that it was a...
We do have supporting observations. So when we went, before the probe even went in, we knew which latitude it was going to go in, and we had done some Hubble observations leading up to it, and we knew the cloud coverage at the time. And a couple years out, we knew there was about a 50% chance of going into a cloud hole. And as it got closer and we could time the longitude, it was pretty much dead on straight in a hole.
Okay. And a hole, I take it, this
literally,
was, as you just said, they were expected. The holes, they extend quite far down.
Apparently.
Yeah.
This
well
particular
said.
Latitude actually is one where we have a planetary wave. And it's a very big wave. It's very high and deep in altitude. And so that's why we're getting these big holes in the clouds.
Wait, now, is that a little bit like the gravity waves in the Earth?
This is a Rossby wave. So not a gravity wave, but big, really big.
Okay.
Planetary scale wave.
I'm just a simple astronomer. Was it a Rossby?
Rossby wave.
I think somebody named Rossby came
up
with it.
Yeah, he came up with it. It's basically these big planetary scale waves. They can be formed a number of different ways. Gravity waves are very specifically inertia buoyancy waves. They tend to be very small scale. This is a big one that's just a function of the fact that the planet rotates. So you will get waves everywhere on these planets. Jupiter Jupiter is the one where we see them very obviously, and we knew, you know, ahead of time we were likely to, it was a really bad choice of latitude. But nonetheless.
Good, thank you.
So from remote sensing, what can we learn? What we do want to do is learn this vertical cloud structure. Now, we don't get a whole lot of leverage on how deep. We can mostly just measure those top clouds. And by doing to do that, we have to look at a variety of different viewing angles and a variety of different wavelengths, and I'll show you that in a minute. And that's one thing we can actually do remotely. We can do dynamics. That's the obvious part. We can see the winds. We can see the clouds moving in the winds. We can see the storms themselves moving separate from the winds. We can do composition. This is primarily in the near-infrared. We have rotational vibrational bands, so a lot of different molecules in the atmosphere. So we can get some compositional information. Again, we don't see these ice features very well, but we do see other features. seasonal effects. So the planets, obviously, just like Earth, all have different tilts, and we get seasons. Jupiter has a very small tilt, but it also has a slightly elliptical orbit, so its northern hemisphere summer is actually hotter than its southern hemisphere summer. So we can get seasonal effects even with very little tilt. Saturn, about the same tilt as the Earth, Neptune kind of close, Uranus way over on its side. So we can get quite extreme seasonal variations. The only problem with that is that it takes a long time to see it. So a year on Jupiter is 12 years, 12 Earth years. By the time we're up to Neptune, we're talking about 200. Sort of something that's been a like to have, been tough to do, we can actually learn something about interior structure looking in the UV-OIR remote sensing. And so this is not getting close and doing gravity measurements. We can actually learn about the interior structure without that. So we'll talk about that in a minute. And lots of other things. So basically the fact that these are resolved objects, they're fairly close. Even in a small telescope, you can resolve Jupiter and Saturn very easily. Uranus and Neptune get a little more tricky. But just the fact that they're resolved and close enough to us that we can observe them frequently means we can learn quite a lot. So when I was talking about how we sense different altitudes, so basically it comes down to wavelength. If we try to look at what we can see in an atmosphere, we can generate these transmission curves. And so what this is that if a photon from the sun is coming into the top of the atmosphere, how deep can it go before it's either absorbed or reflected back? And so at short wavelengths, you get Rayleigh scattering. That's down here. So a photon coming in is just going to bounce off the top of the atmosphere, essentially, and get scattered back. When you get further into the visible, basically, it could go down as deep as it wants if there's no clouds in the way. So on Jupiter or Saturn, the ammonia cloud deck is what you're primarily seeing. You can't see below it because the clouds are in the way. But when you get out to certain wavelengths, more into the infrared, you see these peaks here. A photon coming down would be absorbed way up high in the atmosphere unless there's a cloud or something up high to reflect it back. And so that's primarily methane gas absorption. We also get hydrogen, helium-induced collision. And if you go farther into the infrared, you see hydrocarbon features as well. You get phosphine, you get ammonia, and then you get higher order hydrocarbons. But basically, we can use these different wavelengths to sense different altitudes. Now, the curve assumes cloud-free, but the cloud deck is what stops you, for the most part, in Jupiter. If you did this for Uranus or Neptune, what you find is that same curve is actually very similar features. It's a little bit deeper, and that's partly because it's colder and the radius is different. But if we add the cloud in there, so that's where we think the methane ice cloud sits. What you see is that, again, Rayleigh scattering, you scatter off the top of the atmosphere. You don't get a lot of leverage here in the blue and green wavelengths, and then you start getting these peaks again. But it's not quite the same as what you see in Jupiter or Saturn.
You mean those lines are pressure broadened? Is that how you get pressure, or how do you get the pressure?
There's pressure and there's temperature effect, depending which line it is. So yeah, it all fits in there together.
Yeah.
And so you can do these with line-by-line codes or LDK.
But the curve, this is kind of a high-resolution curve, right? So it's already broadened by the pressure.
Yep. And so most of these peaks here are methane absorption that you're seeing, gaseous methane, but you can get other ones as well. And again, if you went farther into the infrared, you start seeing the others. So what does this actually look like in practice?
And the scale of this curve, how transparent is it in the
50%. So this 50% transmission depth.
Okay, so this is not very good. This is not good at all.
Right. And so, you know, what does this look like in practice? If you did this for Jupiter and you look in the UV, you don't see most of the usual cloud features, right? You see dark polar caps, and that's just because we have a high altitude haze of particulates, and that basically absorbs the UV. But it bounces off the rest of the atmosphere, just really scattering, unless something is super, super high, like the Great Red Spot, which you can see there. If you take it out a little bit farther, you start to see a little bit more of the usual cloud features. In this case, the Red Spot just rotated off. It's still there. You go into the violet and the blue. Now it's really starting to look like what we expect to see for Jupiter. And then if you get out towards red, it starts to get bland again, okay? And so this has to do with what the colors of Jupiter are. But if you looked in a methane filter, you'd see something more like this. Most of the planet goes dark. The only things that are bright are things that are high. So you'll begin a little bit on the polar caps, the Great Red Spot, a little bit in the equatorial zone. So this gives you that sense that you can use these different filters to see different altitudes. And to show it just kind of a little more clearly, we had some Hubble observations where we can map out the whole planet. So this is what all of Jupiter looks like in the near UV. So what's interesting is these filters, you're thinking you can't learn a whole lot about most of the planet. You can learn a little bit about scattering the Great Red Spot. These caps become pretty obvious. And one thing you can actually see is there's wave structure along the edges of the polar caps. And so that's something that we can study only in UV because you can't see this at any other wavelength. Now, if you take this over to the blue and violet, so you can see now that you can see all the standard cloud features, right? Go back and forth. You can watch different areas essentially light up. And so this is actually the primary color if you want to see the most contrast in the clouds on Jupiter. And that's because we have this blue absorber somewhere in there that we're still not sure what it's made of. So that's where these regions look red, the Great Red Spot will look orange, because it's very absorbing at blue wavelength. Now, if you take this to green.
So wait, so the UV is mostly that you don't have that absorbing.
The ultraviolet is Rayleigh scattering.
It's just Rayleigh.
Mm-hmm.
But you said that there's a color to that absorbing. Yes. Rayleigh, so there's something on top of Rayleigh, right?
Yes, that's right. So that's what I'm going to show here is that if you go from the blue to the green, you see color differences now, right? So some areas stay dark at green wavelengths and some start to lighten up. So the Red Spot actually is not as green absorbing as other areas. And so we can build a spectrum up of different regions, and they're not the same. So it is different from place to place on Jupiter. And if you go to red, you know, it's very muted. Again, we don't see a whole lot here because most regions are just bright in the red. It's reflecting, not absorbing. Some regions do stay a little dark. And if you go over to the methane band, it's kind of an inversion of that UV. Now, methane is extremely difficult to use. We need very long exposure times. It's a very narrow filter to stay in that absorption feature. In this case, it's Hubble, and there are some artifacts because there were some satellites in the picture. But we also get fringing, we get vignetting, we get all sorts of weird things that happen in the methane filters. It's actually been harder to do than we expected. But this is the filter that gets us the most low percent cloud height. This is a strong methane band. So then if you compare all that to true color, you know, that's what Jupiter looks like in quasi-true color, a little bit enhanced, a little stretch. And, you know, again, you can see that there are different colors. The Great Red Spot is not red, it's orange. But other regions really are dark reddish-brown. And so they have very different absorption in them, and there's probably some different particle, some different thing that's causing that absorption. So that is a big spectral difference.
So folks are now dialing in. Approximately what page are you on? Doesn't say on the slides here, but
12.
Page 12, folks.
So again, so we're doing this now. We are actually able to do narrowband spectral imaging with these full maps from Hubble so we can learn more about these color differences and what's going on in one region versus another region. So this is one of the things we learn by having that kind of range of colors. Now, if you did this for a different planet, if you did it for Neptune, what would it look like? Well, Neptune is pretty bland, actually, in the blue and greenish kind of wavelengths. You don't see a whole lot of structure there. Unlike Jupiter, it's not where you get that primary contrast. It's actually out in the red. And that's because of that difference in that transmission curve that I was showing you, that we just don't see anywhere close to the cloud deck at those wavelengths because it's just how deep you have to go in the atmosphere to see it. And so you have to get out to the red wavelength to see contrast, and that's where you start to see the cloud features popping up above that haze. And if you keep going, 845, that's probably one of the best bands for seeing contrast in Neptune's clouds or Uranus's clouds. And then 619 and 727 are methane bands. So again, we can use those to get a little bit of leverage on height. It's harder to do this on Uranus and Neptune because the clouds are deeper, so it doesn't look much different at those wavelengths, unlike Jupiter, which really changes what it looks like at those wavelengths. So this kind of tells you what we do when we're trying to pick which color, how we're going to look at dynamics. If we want to do dynamics on Jupiter, we can pretty much pick any color. We tend to do it in the red because you don't get the absorption issue in the way, since everything kind of looks the same. On Neptune and Uranus, we have to do it in the red because that's the only place where we get enough contrast to even see the clouds. So we don't see them at all otherwise. So looking at the types of observations, I want to talk about first light curves. So you would think planetary light curves would be an easy thing to do, right? You'd be wrong. Because they're resolved objects. And so doing it from the Earth is, of course, problematic because of the atmosphere and you get changes. And so if you want to get the whole disk, you know, you're going to get just Earth atmosphere changing over that resolved object. It makes it hard to get a light curve that has any photometry in it. That's also why we can't do AO very well in the visible, by the way. But we'd like to actually look at light curves to observe brightness oscillations in the planets. And this has been proposed for years for trying to understand the interior structure. And it's something that hasn't worked real well in the past, in part because of the photometry, but also because of the rotation rate of the planet versus the rotation rate of Earth. And so you can't track any of these planets continuously from Earth long enough to get the full day on the planet. So 16 hours on Neptune, 10 hours on Jupiter, doesn't mesh real well with a 24-hour Earth rotation where you can only observe for half the night. And so this is something you really want to do from space if you can.
Half the day, although can't you coordinate?
Well, then your photometry is an even bigger problem if you're trying to coordinate between observatories and continuous coverage. So, and clouds.
You can do that like solar people did, like for solar oscillations. I mean, you have a network of telescopes and that
That's actually exactly what we want to do. We want to look for brightness oscillations. And the idea would be to do it similar to the sun or a star, but we obviously want really good photometry. Now, if you look at something like Jupiter, you have all those different cloud structures, right? And so every side of the planet looks slightly different. So that kind of confounds the whole issue. And so you'd really like to do this for Uranus and Neptune, where you only have occasional clouds. You don't have red spots and brown spots and white things. You really want just kind of one color. And sort of the primary thing you'd get out at the first pass would be planetary rotation. Right? It should basically, every time a big thing pops up, it should show up at the same time. In reality, we get differential rotation because none of the clouds move at the rotation rate of these planets. They actually all move at, for the most part, rotation rates that match the zonal wind profile, which can be hundreds of meters per second, which is pretty significant in terms of that period. So, you know, it's not quite as simple to get a planetary rotation period as you might think. It should be, but it isn't. We can't actually get that for Jupiter from the red spot, but we can't do it for the others. But if you were just looking at reflected solar light, you know, what else would you see besides these clouds that pop up? You actually can see solar oscillations if you have good enough photometry. So we can actually see the sun's oscillations off the planet, which is kind of interesting. And then what we'd really like to see is the planetary oscillations. And so the planets themselves have spherical harmonics, and they very slightly pulsate. And it changes the radius just enough that it should change that reflected light back as well. And we know what frequencies that should happen at based on what we think the interior structure is, so you can look for it. And so that's kind of the idea of what we'd like to do is get down to this holy grail where we can actually see the planets pulsate, see the sun pulsate, and then you see the rotation. So it's kind of three levels of things. And going down these, it's easy to see differential rotation, hard to see solar oscillations, but doable. Planetary oscillations are really hard. Two parts per million.
Okay, minus six.
Tiny.
What excites the planetary oscillation?
Actually, it's the rotation and the fact you have winds and waves, basically. It's primarily the waves.
So they're not tidal or anything?
Yeah. They're too far from the sun for it to be tidal.
I mean, from moons.
None of the moons are big enough, really. So we expect these planets to have them. It was predicted back in the 70s and 80s, and just what I was saying, that this change in radius should reflect the solar flux. It also, by the way, affects ring structures. So for something like Saturn, you can actually see changes in the rings based on the fact that the planet is oscillating. So it's changing that gravitational pull on the rings ever so slightly. So that was predicted in the 90s. So have we seen this? So we tried this originally on Jupiter, and it got so confused by the fact that you had all these cloud albedos that varied, bright clouds, dark clouds, that other than maybe getting that red spot, you weren't going to be able to do this very easily. Much more recently, however, they looked in Doppler observations of Jupiter, and they can get acoustic modes on Jupiter now. And so we're actually looking at Doppler imaging of pretty much all the planets. We should be able to see something just doing Doppler imaging. But we can also do a direct light curve. And so then lastly, we also have a possible detection of these waves in Saturn's C ring from Cassini, where we see a ripple that goes out in the waves that seems to be tied to this, that goes out in the ring. So one of the things we proposed was to try to do this with Kepler. Now, in Kepler's current K2 campaign, basically it stares at one field of view in the sky, it moves to a different one, and so on. It turned out Neptune, in one of the campaigns, is going to be crossing the field of view. And so several groups put in proposals, and they all got merged together to do this. And we were able to get a 49-day observation with 98% coverage, 1-minute cadence. So this is the fast cadence Kepler mode. We have more data with 30-minute cadence, but that's not quite as useful for this. And so if you want to see what this looks like, if I can get my thingy. That's the Kepler field that we were looking at. And you'll see about day 15, Neptune's going to pop into the field of view. Now, a Kepler pixel is about 4 arc seconds. Neptune is 2, so it's less than a pixel.
Triton. As you say, is that a moon?
That's Triton.
Oh, wow.
And that's Nereid following it.
Oh, wow.
And it's the asteroids that's through, too. There goes one. And so it does saturate. It's about magnitude 7, give or take. But because it was designed to do precision photometry, we don't actually, particularly around 8th magnitude, we don't lose any photons. So the electrons get transferred down the CCD, and you can add it back together. You don't actually lose any of the photometry. So that's actually a real nice thing about this data set. And so that's what the light curve looks like. Now, this has taken out the fact that the telescope rolls. There's, you know, different motions in there that have to be cleaned up. That's your about 2% variations in Neptune's brightness that we see over 49 days. Now, if you look closely at that, you'll see that there's obviously big variations. It looks like there's a beat frequency on top of that. So we think more than one variation is probably in there. And if you just zoom in, it's an awfully nice light curve. Again, there's a lot of detail in there.
And if you just get a mouse on that, I mean, show a couple.
You were, listen, no more questions. He's one slide ahead.
And so we can run a periodogram on it. This is a lone gargle. We do have some dropouts, so I tried this first, assuming we don't have evenly spaced data. And we get a couple main periods. So this big one here is about 16.8 hours. Neptune's rotation is 16.1 hours. You don't see any peaks at 16.1 hours, no big surprise. And what I did on each of these, you'll see I put a latitude next to these peaks. That's based on the zonal wind profile. So assuming a feature is moving with the zonal wind profile, it would have that period. So this was just the first way of guessing where we think those periods are coming from. Now, this was a lone circle, and if any of you have messed with those, you know that it'll tell you all these peaks are really significant. It doesn't mean anything. It's not very mathematically rigorous, let's say. So we actually have gone back and done this again with Fourier transform and done noise levels and checked against it. And the 90% confidence level is about here. So these three main peaks are all above the 90% confidence level, without a doubt. They're above the 99.9% confidence level. The others are maybe a little questionable. But you'll notice there's a lot of different periods in there. And so one question we had was that we know that Neptune's clouds change over time, and we also know that brown dwarfs have a lot of variability in their light curves. And the question was, are the spots varying? Why do we see variability in a brown dwarf light curve? Can we say anything about Neptune the same way? And so we did the same thing where we looked at the period over a couple day chunks, so about 5 rotations of Neptune. Did we see any variation in the period? We do. And what that's telling us is that different clouds are dominating on different days. And so if one feature happens to be really bright for a few days, it might dominate the light curve. Even though overall that other one period really pops out, on various days you do get these other features. And we did some rotationally phased diagrams for different those different days. And, yeah, that's probably what's in there, although there's a lot of other variation.
So this is related to differential rotation.
Mm-hmm. And so, okay, that's all nice. But the whole point is we have resolved objects in the solar system. We can look at them. We should look at them. So we did. And that's Keck data that was taken for context. This was not our observing run. This was actually somebody else's. We beg, borrow, and steal all the time in planetary. And some very nice folks looked at Neptune for us. And you can see there's quite a lot of cloud activity. There's this really bright storm here. And when I map them out, you can see it here. And we have little structures all over the place, essentially. And so this is that period, that feature that we see at 16.8 hours. That ties directly to that latitude, and we see it if we watch that feature move. We see that. It's not a methane band, but it's, everything is dark at that wavelength, so basically you're seeing the high clouds. So this was taken actually towards the end of that Kepler run, so it does overlap the Kepler data. But we also had Hubble data that we acquired later on. The question was, how much does this stuff really vary over time? And so we took Hubble data in September, so this was 9 months after the Kepler data. Turns out that bright storm's still there. All the other little clouds come and go. And we had enough Hubble data, we could make our own light curve from that, and that's the plus lines on here. The dashed line is that same 16.8-hour period, just to see if it's a close match, and there's a couple of Kepler curves thrown in there for good measure. And, you know, really, that feature dominates all of our light curves. The little variations that we see on top of it are things like this guy here or some of the other latitudes. Now, you'll notice that we're not looking at Neptune, you know, equator on. We're looking at it tilted. So that's going to affect where these periods show up as well. So this guy here is actually hard to spot in any of the light curves, and part of it is because it extends over a long area of longitude, but also it doesn't disappear off the planet very long because Neptune is so tilted. And so that's one thing we haven't done is taken the known inclination of Neptune and run this in a stellar spot model to see if we can validate what they find in their models. And so that's sort of the next step of this. But it's just kind of a fun thing that we could do where we could look at all these different data sets. Now, this is all fine and dandy, but Kepler is actually a really broad band path. It's over most of the visible. It's not looking at just the red. Now, Kepler, this is stretched, but the Kepler variations were only 2%. The Hubble variations are about 16%, and that's because I'm only looking at that red wavelength. If I went and looked at a blue wavelength, it's 0.5% because we have no structure at the blue wavelength. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean that the blue and the UV aren't useful. If we do a color view of Neptune, we do the same maps but in color, so using the short wavelength, we have a couple dark bands. That's the bright storm. That's the other one towards the south. This is the only data set that we have that shows you that there's actually a dark feature associated with the bright feature.
And then again, what page is
on? This is on page 26. And this is the same, looks very similar to what we saw with Voyager. When Voyager flew by Neptune, there was a great dark spot, you might remember. And it had little companion clouds, bright white clouds, that tracked with it the whole time. They didn't move on their own. They tracked with this dark storm. And so it kind of, the whole thing moved at the big complex. And it's kind of similar to a great red spot, really. So it's definitely a vortex. The Voyager dark spot disappeared. It was gone by the time Hubble came on the scene. So when Hubble first looked at Neptune, there was no great dark spot. It was just gone. And so what we think happens on Neptune is that these storms, they're not quite as high to latitude as they are on Jupiter. And just like on Earth, it moves towards the equator and breaks apart. So it's kind of like a hurricane on Earth. So it dissipates. And so we think we might have a new one forming, essentially. And we've been tracking this now for more than a year. The amateurs can actually just barely bring it out in their images, if you believe that pixel. So we think that we actually have a fairly big storm system on Neptune that's just been around for a while now. And we'll get Hubble data again in a year, so we'll look again.
Is there a theory that can predict time scales you'd expect the formation of these stations?
Not really. So when we run circulation models of the giant planets in general, it's really hard to get these vortices to form, even though they should form all over the place. So analytically speaking, you know, from the fluid dynamics equations, we should get them all the time. Really hard to do them in a GCM, and once you get them, it's hard to keep them. And so there's still something missing that we're trying to figure out, getting these things to form and stick around. So, you know, certainly something like the Great Red Spot, which is 150 years old-ish, shouldn't be here if you listen to those models. So speaking of which, we can do feature tracking and monitoring. There's the Great Red Spot. Thank you. Thanks, Ryan. So this is something we've been tracking over time. Again, we can see this pretty easily from the ground, but having the high resolution and also having the ultraviolet and methane wavelengths gives us a lot of leverage on its altitude and other changes that you can't see from just visible. And one thing we've been able to track is the fact that it is shrinking. That was actually known since probably the early 1900s. We can track it back to 1870-ish, and you can actually track the size of it over that whole time. But it's kind of interesting that in our lifetime, over 20 years, I mean, it's really different. This doesn't look like, you know, the Voyager pictures that I saw in textbooks growing up. So it's something that we can watch pretty closely, and what we're trying to understand is, you know, what is going on? Is it's looking much more circular. Is it going to hit a preferred shape and stop there? That's kind of what we think will most likely happen. Could it go away? Sure. You know, we just don't know. But we also don't know what powers it. And that's one of these things that we really need the high spatial resolution to be able to understand. And so this is actually a set of images from 2008 where we were actually watching this storm to the south passing the Great Red Spot. We wanted to see if it bumps it a little bit in latitude. But we got lucky, and it turns out there was another little storm coming in during this sequence, and we actually watched it get pulled apart. And part of it got sucked into the Great Red Spot. Part of it kept going. So one of the things we think happens is these little eddies essentially help feed it. They certainly feed new clouds in, but they probably also feed in momentum and energy. And so it's, you know, kind of an ongoing problem we're trying to understand. But we certainly need the high resolution to be able to see this thing. We couldn't easily see this from the ground. But the other nice thing, of course, is having Hubble, we could look in the infrared as well. So this is NICMOS data. This is in a methane band. So again, Jupiter gets dark, the high stuff gets light. And you can see very clearly the parts that continued on in this sequence, where you can't see that as easily.
It seems like in the second image, the red spot itself has brightened.
It does.
And portion that point of the storm that's
crazy. Yeah, so we think, I mean, some new material came in on this side, so we expect the top part to get brighter. You know, depending how far along it is, sometimes you can see it coming around to the bottom again. But yeah, that is from the new material, because this is kind of like your gravity wave problem, where if you view the Great Red Spot kind of like spinning mountains, stuff comes in and rises as it goes around the top part. So we can obviously track storms on Jupiter. We can actually do this on Saturn as well. And the Saturn, this color is a little bit enhanced. You can't see a whole lot of structure of anything going on here. I mean, it's enhanced, so it does look like it has bands. It doesn't look quite as hazy as you normally see. You can see the polar hexagon. That's pretty much always there. But if you add in the methane bands, now all of a sudden there's storms that pop up that you can see. And that's actually what we had proposed to do with this. We were looking at a storm near the pole. But if you didn't have the methane bands, you wouldn't see it very well. So this is definitely something you could not see from the ground. The only reason we were even alerted to this is we actually had a high-resolution Cassini image, so we happened to see it. And now you can't retarget Cassini on the fly, so Cassini went on its merry way doing its thing, but we were able to get Hubble on it. So we can track the Saturn storms. I just showed you the Neptune storm. Again, we can throw in some of the methane bands. And we get a little bit more clarity on some of these features that you certainly don't get in the visible. And I didn't put it in here, but we actually have Uranus data from 2014 and 2015, and we can actually track storm activity on Uranus as well. In 2014, we saw quite a bit, actually, but we can actually watch it evolve over about 40 minutes. So really fast changes. And then in 2015, it was all gone. So that, you know, there's some value to being able to look frequently. So besides the storms themselves, there's other things we can track on the planets. We can look at color. So the North Equatorial Belt, that's where we have the really deep red colors that I was pointing out earlier on Jupiter. If we look at that over time, the spectrum doesn't change. It's pretty much the reddest stuff on the planet. It's always the reddest stuff on the planet. If we look at the Great Red Spot, on the other hand, the center of the Great Red Spot, which should be its deepest color as well, it actually changes quite a bit. And in 2014, 2015, it suddenly got really orange, really dark at some wavelengths, way more so than at other wavelengths. And that's kind of an ongoing thing. We're trying to understand what's going on here. And this has to do with, similar to those little storms that you saw getting sucked in 2008, as the Great Red Spot has continued to shrink, not just shrinking this way, it's shrinking this way too. So shrinking in latitude. And because it's shrinking in latitude, it's not interacting with the wind jets as much as it was. So those little storms, if they come in, can just pass it by. They don't get sucked in. So those white clouds don't form and the color can intensify. So what we're trying to understand now is, okay, we get that it's a more intense color and we don't have the new white clouds. What else is changing? Is there more photochemical reactions going on? We actually have some lab experiments now going on. Two separate groups are doing this on two different compounds and both saying they have the answer. So this is going to be an interesting battle. Maybe join. Now, most of what we've been able to do with Hubble up until this point has been what we call zonal variations. And by that, I mean that we can look at a change in color or change in winds with latitude, but we're looking at one set of longitudes when we do that. That's because we don't have these full global maps. And you need more than one full global map to get winds at all longitudes. And so if the Great Red Spot happens to be in the view that you have, that's going to bias things. It's going to bias the color. It's going to bias the winds. And that's true of pretty much any longitude. You know, these latitudes where we have waves, if you happen to be looking at the longitudes where the wave is at its high point, nice and bright, it's at its low point, it's dark. And so doing this, we can get some information. We were trying to look for variations on Jupiter, both short-term and long-term, and we were having a real problem doing it. And one of the issues was that, of course, we have huge time gaps with absolutely no data. That doesn't really help you a whole lot. But also, because we were only looking at specific longitudes, we have potential biases in there. And so while this was a great start, it was kind of still leaving us confounded. We couldn't see the things that we even knew were there because of time gaps. Now, this is over 1994 to 2008, so this was almost entirely with WIPIC 2. So it was a single camera on Hubble, and there were still calibration issues over time. It just wasn't real stable, particularly at the UV wavelength. And so that's kind of been a problem. So one of the things we proposed recently with Hubble was called the OPAL program, which is the Outer Planets Atmospheres Legacy Program, where we wanted to get global maps of all four of the outer planets every single year. So all using Wide-Field Camera 3, same camera, don't get the time gaps, get full coverage so that we don't have any of those biases by just having whatever longitudes we can look at. And so that's something I'll show you towards the end that we're just doing now. But even with just having one longitude, we can still do what we call kind of snapshot science. And so this is looking at some variation. A seasonal signal would have popped up out here. The short-term signals, some of those might actually be real. There are oscillations on Jupiter that are tied to its stratosphere, so that's actually what we're looking for with this. But we'll have a much better handle on that when we can look at the whole planet. But with just a snapshot, we can still do dynamics. So that's the Great Red Spot. Now, this is an automated method to try to pick up wind vectors around the Great Red Spot. And you can see it finds millions of vectors, but you can see most of them aren't moving, right? They're tiny. And that's because we can only get really short time periods of either beginning to end of a Hubble orbit, which is 45 minutes, or one Hubble orbit to the next, which is 10 hours. And in this particular case, the 10 hours wasn't usable. When we took this data set, it was specifically to look at the Great Red Spot. Our second orbit, Ganymede Shadow, was sitting right on top of the Great Red Spot. Really, really poor timing. Made for a really cool image, but it's not really good for the science. So this is an ongoing project where we're trying to do these dynamics. But you can see the things that are moving really fast, we can obviously pick up motion. The stuff that's not moving as fast, we just need a longer time base. And so, you know, snapshot dynamics is great, but it's not perfect. What we'd rather have is long-term movies. And so this is chart 29. This is a movie from, I believe, Cassini as it approached Jupiter on its flyby. And it loops. But you can still see rotation in the Great Red Spot. Now you can see the cloud bands are moving relative to each other. You can even see a little activity pops up in some of the cells. So this is actually why one of the reasons why we want to do this stuff in space is the fact that we can get longer time coverage over multiple rotations. We learn a heck of a lot more than we can from just that snapshot, because we can now see a whole lot of detailed motion.
Planning to do 3D radio?
Oh, that would be really tough. In part because, you know, the only place you get that altitude variation is on the edge of the planet. You can't get it when you're looking straight down.
So obviously, James Webb, at least long range. So I guess just this is a future telescope talk. I was wondering, are there limitations to what you'll be able to do with James Webb, possibly W-first even?
So Webb, there's a bunch of limitations. Well, UV aside, with Webb, there's a bunch of limitations, one being that it can only look essentially a quadrature for us. We prefer to look at opposition when it's at highest resolution. That you can get around, but these objects are pretty bright, so for some wavelengths, it's going to be tough to do with Webb because it's too sensitive, ironically. The other thing, of course, is that our objects are moving, so you have to track them pretty accurately, which, you know, hopefully Webb will have that capability. And obviously, we've gotten around that for Hubble, works for Hubble. So this is just looking at one area, and this is about 10 rotations of the planet, so about 100 hours. Not too long, actually. We actually can do longer than that. And we did this with both Voyager 1 and 2 and with Cassini. Basically, as they were approaching Jupiter for their gravity assist, we had months where we could just stare at the planet at a fairly low phase angle. So we're looking at the lit side of the planet, and you could just take snapshot after snapshot after snapshot and make a movie out of them. So for Voyager 1, it was 114 rotations. For Voyager 2, 143. We got a good 3 months of coverage out of Cassini. So we could do some really nice approach movies. Now, in theory, you could do the same thing at Saturn with Cassini. However, a good fraction of the time, you're too close. You actually need to be farther back so you can see the whole planet. The idea behind this is you can use many rotations to watch future evolution. And so during the Jupiter flyby with Cassini, we did this. We were looking at a region near the equator where we see little clouds. We were trying to determine what kind of feature they were. Turns out, if you watch them, they start bouncing. So there's actually a whole lot of complicated stuff in there. They actually turn over. It looks almost like waves crashing on the beach. And what we think is actually going on there is there's a bigger wave that you can't see. It mirrors a wave on the north. And so these little fine scale, little bees in the clouds, are actually tracking a bigger wave at the same time. And they're basically riding over that wave. And so if we didn't have that movie, we never would have seen that. And so this is actually tracked to as if they weren't moving, so that's why we can actually see them bouncing. We were able to determine there's another wave there that matches the wave to the north. So that was kind of a cool thing we were able to do. The other thing we can do when we have full global maps is that instead of doing snapshots on the winds, we can actually take the entire map and do a correlation. So we could do a full 2D wind field, but just as the first pass, you could take a full map correlated against the other one. And that's actually what was done with Cassini data in 2000. Voyager measurements are actually all manual measurements. Cassini was correlation. So we just did this with HST just to see if the wind field has changed or not. And it's pretty constant. That's one of the things we know, that Jupiter's wind field doesn't change a whole lot. It does change in some of the wind jets, a little bit, this jet in particular, and then some of the others. So this now tells us the areas to go back and look at in more detail, see if the clouds have changed there, see if the velocities have changed there. And so even just a quick look at the correlation, we can learn quite a lot. Not even before we've done the 2D wind field. And so now we're not biased by the fact that Great Red Spot might be sitting in a certain place because we're looking at all longitudes at the same time. And so that's exactly what the point behind the Hubble campaign was the fact that we could do these full global maps, and we do two maps, not just one, two, back-to-back so we can see all those features. And so two maps back-to-back, you can see features moving back and forth. These are separated by 10 hours, so basically a full rotation of Jupiter. And so we got this last January. This coming February, we'll have another set of Jupiter. We have two sets on Uranus, and we have one set on Neptune. We'll have another set on Neptune next year. And then starting the following year after Cassini ends, we'll add Saturn to the mix. So we'll be able to do this monitoring for all four of the other planets. And And as I showed you in the map earlier, we have this a bunch of different wavelengths. This is just color because, you know, the color is pretty to look at. But we have this in the UV. We have it in blue, green, red, methane bands, and so on. So we can look at this across all the different wavelengths as well.
So it seems to be a fair bit of north-south asymmetry on Jupiter. Is that because of the eccentricity you mentioned?
So actually, Jupiter is remarkably symmetric.
That's what I meant.
So there are slight variations. One thing we don't understand is why you tend to get more of these stable anticyclones in the south. There's a whole bunch of them here there than in the north. That might be slightly tied to this very slight tilt to its to the planet and to its orbit. We don't know. That's kind of the higher level problem. We're still trying to get the models to make vortices and to make the right wind profile. So once we have that, then we can add these tilts and see if that affects which hemisphere gets more of these things or not.
Those zonal winds you showed, I think, of the previous plot,
mm-hmm.
were those all taken in the same season? Or
no. No, they weren't. So that's the other thing we have. We can track now over very Jupiter's season or year only being 12 years means that we now have a long enough time base. We can look for those seasonal sort of effects. One thing that you probably can't see real well in this map, but there's actually a wave feature hidden in this cloud up here that we had seen in Voyager, but we've never seen any other time. When New Horizons flew by, there were really fine scale gravity waves all across the equator. Never seen them any other time. And we're wondering if some of that stuff might be also tied to the fact you get slight changes in insulation for northern summer versus southern summer. So that's, like I said, that's kind of the higher order problem after we can get the main planet to work. Okay, and then we have the same sort of global idea from Voyager. Now, this is the full Voyager 2 movie. Not real pretty. There's a lot of data dropouts. So it's actually a long-term project to eventually get this cleaned up. But it's nice because you can see all sorts of interesting feature evolution. You can watch one of these guys just suddenly light up right there. You can also watch a storm pops up east of the red spot, and then another, and then another, and then another. So we think there's a propagating wave that's leading in front of the great red spot as it pushes through the wind, essentially. There's quite a lot to be learned by being able to, even in a single color, being able to do a movie. So, you know, back to why can't we do this other way? We hinted on some of this already. You know, the time coverage from the Earth's rotation is problematic for these planets just because they don't sync up, and we want to get continuous coverage. We don't want gaps. A visible wavelength without the AO spatial resolution can be really low. And so we've looked at this during the New Horizons flyby for Jupiter. I had Hubble data, and at the same time, the amateurs were feeding us images, and in some cases, the amateur images look better than Hubble. You're wondering, well, why is that? It's because they're taking video and they're stacking 60,000 frames to make a single image, and it has no photometry whatsoever, but they can make fake really high resolution, which is great for, you know, a snapshot, but it doesn't help with some of these problems. And then, of course, from the ground, we don't have the UV capability or any of the IR and the telluric bands.
But, you know, ground-based, you know, you say amateurs give better videos for you, but, you know, some telescope like IRTF, would be doing that typically. So did you try that, or did you get any data from them?
Here's the problem. We don't have video capability on pretty much any observatory at the moment. On IRTF, we primarily do the IR, obviously, not
right.
Visible. But we've had discussions about it. Some of it's how do you keep the photometry with such rapid cadence data.
Right. Quick snapshots and then shoot them dead at least.
And we've certainly talked about it. But obviously you can't do a full movie that way because you just don't get the time coverage at that rapid cadence. And then, you know, why don't we do this all in our target-driven deep space missions, you know, our Cassinis or Galileos, and some of it is that, well, of course, money. You know, if you want to give us a $3 billion, $4 billion mission every other year, we'll take it.
Hands off astronomy.
It's going to happen. But also, you know, as I mentioned for Cassini, it's just too close to do this global monitoring. You know, it's zoomed in on a moon, it's zoomed in on a little cloud feature ring. But it's just too close to do global monitoring. And also, we also have the time is just limited because you are trying to do all these things at the same time. So if you ever look at a Cassini timeline, it's broken down to the minute. And, you know, every few minutes you're changing targets. So you're just not doing this kind of coverage.
Or you share Cassini has 12 instruments on board, so you
can. Cassini has a downlink problem.
Yeah.
It can record more data than it can send back.
Plus, you can't sit and stare at Saturn with one instrument for 12 hours and do something with what you want to do.
Right.
It's not going to happen.
So there's reasons why we can't just do it from a target-driven mission. Now, we've looked into Discovery-class missions where we're basically Earth-based and have a dedicated Hubble, essentially, but we still end up usually driven to trying to look at too many things at the same time. So.
Do you need the spatial resolution that good? Because I've been pondering if you had a CubeSat, then you get down to a very small aperture, 8 to 10 centimeters.
Yeah, 1 meter is about the limit. And, you know, lastly, even though I'm talking specifically about having a dedicated sort of campaign, there's a lot of value in combined observations. So this is actually that same.
And again, Amy, what page for this?
35.
Okay, thanks.
So this is actually that same Jupiter Hubble map in the background, and on top of it is an IRTF map. Now you'll notice there's gaps in coverage because we can't look continuously with the IRTF. You have to wait for Jupiter to rotate around. But if you line it up, this is 5-micron emission. So basically, places where there's holes in the clouds, we can see the heat from the interior coming out, and this is where those holes, the Galileo probe went into one of those. But it's nice that we can now correlate these features, which areas are hot, with a visible image at the same time. There's a lot of value in doing this from different ways if we can. So if we can get the infrared from the ground, that's great. But there are obviously some things we just can't do. So in summary, the full wavelength range is really valuable. The atmospheric dynamics, particularly the vertical structure, we really do need everything from the UV to the infrared, preferably at different emission angles, looking straight down, looking at the limb, so we can get that leverage on the cloud height. And, of course, the time coverage is really valuable. This long-term monitoring, not just for feature evolution, but for being able to do the detailed dynamics, looking at these long-term oscillations in planets, all sorts of time domain science is what we've decided to call it. We don't call it monitoring. Time domain. So, you know, of course, we'd love a dedicated observatory if you want to give us one. But we're actually happy to get frequent coverage in any form we can get it. What it comes down to, and we're leveraging as much as we can now. So, you know, I showed you the Kepler observations of Neptune. We have Uranus. We're going to do Uranus in February, so we'll be doing that same sort of analysis on Uranus. And we've been looking at doing Doppler imaging from ground-based and then space-based. So any place we can get a platform, we're happy to look. Okay.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. I believe we have this room, if Amy's got the time, if folks have, including folks online, if folks have questions. I have a quick, speaking of Cassini, what is the future plans for Cassini?
So it's headed into its proximal orbit. It goes into a polar orbit that dives below the rings, and eventually it'll crash into the planet. 2017 is end of mission.
I've been told that the word crash is disapproved.
Plunge.
It gracefully enters the atmosphere and gets crushed into a little ball.
In terms of you're using narrowband imaging a lot, but there's also IFQs or ways to get spectra.
Yeah.
Of course, you could probably sacrifice this resolution because something is large. So what is your trade-off? Are there certain applications that...
Yeah, we talked about this too, you know, in our ideal observatory, our theoretical observatory where we have the aperture we want, we've also got a large format IFU because we'd love to get that simultaneous spectrum and image at the same time. And again, it kind of comes down to that pixel size. We wouldn't really want to go worse than about a tenth of an arc second if we could.
I mean, and so is it really possible to create an IFU that could see a significant chunk of Jupiter while also achieving, I mean, that's...
Not currently. Not currently. It doesn't, and, you know, the data rate would be enormous. That's the other problem.
But if not IFU, would that help with, you know, like, selected spectra of chunks of the planet and then hyperspectral at them?
That's already what we do, actually.
But you're taking you know, band, narrow band, images, but if you can have, like, at every point, if you have a spectral, low resolution spectrum, say 100 or something, probably.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do it. I was showing imaging primarily, but we do have various spectrometers, imaging spectrometers that are lower spatial resolution, higher spectral resolution. We do that as well. That's, we usually kind of draw that line on, Cassini has one, Galileo had one, it's mapping spectrometers. There's still some limits in how they push for them, but it's better than nothing.
The GCM modeling, you say it's not successful in getting the storm to last. When they do these models, do they account for things like storm merging?
Sometimes. Again, so it depends which one they're running. The two main ones people run are EPIC and the MIT GCM. And the big problem is MIT GCM works better global. EPIC works better local. And basically to get the right number of grid elements and whatever, the local tends to work better, but then you're missing the boundary conditions. So it's really hard to get everything working at the same time.
But that sounds like solvable problem when you just need to
computational power
on it.
Some people are working it.
Okay, so do you think that when that happens, the storm duration problem will go away?
No. There's a lot of microphysics, and that's the part that's the trickier part to get in there right now. So there's basically the convection and condensation, those sorts of things. They're just starting to add that stuff now. And they've done it very localized, but I think they need that on a bigger scale.
Is there any chance that the heat budget is off?
Probably. Mm-hmm. And again, the boundary conditions as well is just problematic.
Is it thought that the Great Red Spot is some, on the same topic, Great Red Spot is an outlier, and there appears to be a spectrum of these vortices in size. Great Red Spot might be an outlier, and too much work has been concentrated on that.
Some folks have looked more at the small scale stuff.
Right. And they're still equally unsuccessful with the small stuff.
You can generate a thunderstorm.
Yeah.
Basically a plume that comes up and breaks apart, but getting a vortex to stay is just really tough. And even the models that spontaneously generate them, they tend to fall apart. It's a very interesting problem why it's so hard to do it. And again, these are anticyclones, not cyclones. On Earth, cyclones are much more stable than anticyclones. And there are cyclones on Jupiter, too. That's the other thing that everybody focuses on, these anticyclones, the round ones, but there's fluffy ones in between that are cyclones. So.
Amy, the K2 light curves from Neptune, when I thought it just been right, you know essentially the shape of the light curve from a single cloud spot, right? It's going to, it's kind of polar, it may be sinusoidal or maybe sinusoidal and then just cut out. If you included that information in your timing analysis, do you think you could essentially subtract out a lot of that amplitude noise to try to get towards those global oscillations?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the next step. And so we do have folks working it right now. The solar oscillations are doable. The Neptune ones are going to be the tough one. And part of it is because while we think there's modes that should be there, we don't actually know which modes are going to be there. It does depend on the interior structure. We don't know that well. So that one's a little bit tougher because you also don't know where to look. We know exactly what the period of solar oscillations are. So that's actually fairly easy to pull out. But you're right, and I think we're also going to be looking at, like I said, that spot modeling, pretending Neptune is a brown dwarf. What would it say is there? Where do those spots land? And some of it is the fact that they're not going to be perfectly, sinusoidal, or some of them are going to be biased because they're polar. But, yeah, that's sort of our next step.
Other questions, including folks on the phone line. Other questions for Amy? Great. Let's thank Amy again. Thank you.